We can start. We're going to resume our conversation deliberations with a conversation on business combinations on the common control, and I give that on to Julia.
Thank you, Hans. Carlo will tee up our paper for today.
Okay. Thank you, Julia. And good afternoon, ESAF members. The purpose of this session is to seek your views on whether current value approach based on acquisition method in IFRS 3 should be applied to all BCUCC transactions when NCI in the receiving entity is affected, and if not, how that distinction could be made. The paper will also be discussed by the board at an education session this month. The staff will provide an update to the board on the feedback received from the ESAF members. The paper does not consider information needs of other primary users, as defined in the conceptual framework, in particular, information needs of lenders and other creditors and prospective investors in an IPO. These topics will be explored in future papers. In exploring these approaches, the staff observed that on conceptual basis, information needs of NCI are the same regardless of their nature and size. However, the cost-benefit analysis can be different on different cases. The staff also noted that there is no perfect approach. Applying a current value approach to all or only some BCUCC transactions affecting NCI has its own advantages and disadvantages. This is explored in paragraphs 13 to 19 of the paper. We observe that requiring a current value approach in all instances has the following advantages. It always provides the most useful information about the transaction to the NCI. It is a simple approach and would prevent entities from structuring transactions by changing the size or nature of the NCI. And using acquisition method as the basis provides a familiar foundation that is already described in IFRS, applied in practice and well understood. But on the other hand, we have identified the following disadvantages. Arguably, it would not take into account cost constraint. In addition, although it would prevent structuring transactions by changing the size or nature of the NCI, it could allow structuring by simply creating an NCI. Finally, it does not take into account the fact that some NCI may have access to information and thus does not solely rely on the general purpose financial statements of the receiving entity. On that basis and on balance, we think that requiring a current value approach to only some cases is a better approach. Mm-hmm. That brings us to the next question. How do we make a distinction between transactions when we do and do not require a current value approach? In abstract, this could be done through a qualitative approach, a quantitative approach, or a combination of the two. Under a qualitative approach, the distinction could be made based on whether the receiving entity's equity instruments are publicly traded. Alternatively, a distinction could be based on the type of NCI. For example, whether the NCI is held by related parties or employees of the receiving entity or controlling party. Qualitative approach is discussed in paragraphs 24 to 35 of the paper. Under a quantitative approach, distinction could be made when the size of the NCI meets a particular threshold. This is discussed in paragraphs 36 to 43 of the paper. Under a combination of qualitative and quantitative approach, distinction could be made when NCI exhibits a particular qualitative or quantitative characteristic, or both. We noted that no approach is perfect in all respects. In particular, some approaches are more open to structuring opportunities than others. On balance, we think that making a distinction based on whether the receiving entity's equity instruments are publicly traded is a viable approach to explore. This is because such distinction would provide the most useful information for NCI in public entities. It does not introduce a bright line, and thus, in our view, least vulnerable to structuring opportunities. It also builds on the approaches described in our existing literature. A similar approach could also be applied when the receiving entity's debt instruments are publicly traded. And finally, it is clear and relatively simple to apply. The main disadvantage of this approach is that it would not result in current value information provided to private NCI. To address that, and to also address the cost constraint, a quantitative threshold could be introduced for private NCI. However, we think that the quantitative threshold would create structuring opportunities. Now we draw your attention back to the question laid out in the cover paper. Do you think a current value approach should be applied to all or some BCUCC transactions that affect NCI? And if a current value approach is applied to only some transactions that affect NCI, how do you think the distinction should be made? And with that, we open the floor for discussion.
Tina?
The staff paper highlights some tension and challenges in, I guess, determining the right approach on a measurement basis for all or some BCUCC, and if it's the latter, then how to draw the line. And AOSSG members in general echo those challenges, and I think they've highlighted or mentioned that it is staff paper have captured that very well. And in fact, I think in one of the meetings before, I might have mentioned that the AOSSG in general have found it particularly difficult to sort of draw the line and to look at, you know, what information needs is more important based on the different stakeholders, and particularly in situations where you've got public entities or public listed entities. So because you've got the controlling party and the non-controlling interest. So, but having said that, a majority of the group believes that we need to bear in mind that we are creating requirements for general purpose financial statements. So we should be considering the information, you know, that is useful to general users that can't demand their own financial the information on their own. So the AOSSG doesn't actually quite support the determining the accounting by looking at whether the transaction impacts or affects NCI. The group recommends the board to consider the accounting more from the perspective of whether there is commercial substance, so whether the transaction has commercial substance. And conceptually, the group believes that if a BCUCC has commercial substance, then it should be accountable for using the same accounting. And what that means is a majority of them would agree that if that means, you know, it has the same commercial substance as a third party combination with third party would have, then current value would be relevant in that case.
EH?
I have the probably the same view with Christina, and ISB has been done a lot of work for BCUCC in the past, and I still have the question and concern about we really have to focus on NCI, existence of NCI, and we have to consider NCI as a very critical factor in determining the accounting method, because if we go back to the basic, why we did separate, exclude BCUCC from general business combination, I would say the reason is because the nature of BCUCC is different from general business combination, as long as there is a controlling shareholders. And it is not because the reason why we excluded BCUCC from general business combination is not because the user is different, not because the user of the primary user of the finance statement is controlling parties. And it is very important because general financial reporting is primarily for the general users, which is obviously NCI, not controlling party. And that means we have to go back to the question and we have to ask ourselves the existence of NCI again affect the nature of BCUCC. If I put it different way, BCI with NCI is really different from BCUCC without NCI. And we have to answer the question. So if we really distinguish NCI with BCUCC with NCI different from BCCC without NCI, meaning that there's two different nature of BCCC. Then we have to continue this consideration of NCI in terms of one method should be used, one for general BCCC and the other for BCCC without NCI. But if we conclude that BCCC is the same thing, regardless of whether there exists an NCI or not, then I think we better stop talking about this NCI existence. So the nature should be NCI really affected the nature of the transaction, nature of the business combination. I think that's the important factor. And obviously, existence of NCI could be considered when we determine the nature of BCCC. But if that's the case, NCI is not the only factor. We have to consider all different things which will really affect the fundamental of the nature of the BCCC. And I think it's a little bit uncomfortable that we very much focus on existence of NCI. If NCI is very important in determining the nature of the business combination with BCCC, then we have to put together all different elements, not just NCI. So my suggestion is that we better focus more on the accounting method for BCCC in general. General BCCC, what is the best method in accounting? I think that's the first thing we have to decide. And then we may say that BCCC, we should use current value method or predecessor method. Then we will say if there is any incident where the nature of BCCC is a little bit different, change it, then we can give some exemption or whatever. I think that's my point.
Hans, can I maybe make a couple of clarifications?
Yes.
So we to the question about whether BCCC are similar to regular business combinations or whether they are different, we are going to look at it. So we need to sequence topics, and we are going to look at the types of the transactions and whether the acquisition method in IFRS 3 will be modified or needs to be modified. So this is coming. The other point I would like to highlight that regardless of whether BCCC are the same as regular business combinations or not, we need to consider the cost constraint as well. And the cost constraint for the cost constraint consideration for BCCC can well be different compared to regular business combinations. And this is because in a regular business combination, you have a dispersed set of investors and lenders and creditors, whereas in a business combination under common control, you have a controlling party that does have access to information. And therefore, the overall assessment of cost-benefit can be different. So that's why we are approaching it from the types of primary user in the first instance.
Anthony.
It's clear that if we looked across the whole of the all BCCC, we'd have to start thinking about other stakeholders, etc. But I think that's a bigger story. I think this paper is trying to say, in this subpopulation, does it matter? And the reason why people focus on NCI, I think we just be careful to understand that. I think sometimes it's two differing reasons and they confuse the two. One is something to do about trying to protect the non-controlling interest, as if somehow the reporting will make sure that their position isn't undermined. If there's anything to be done on that, then that's probably, to your point, something to do with the consideration paid. It's something about this not being a fair value transaction in the first place, the consideration paid. But I think if you put that to one side, which is when you would have to start modifying IFRS 3, if you're looking here, which is what I was trying to do, just looking at this in terms of using the fair value of the assets and liabilities acquired, then it's really about, is that information useful and is it worth the cost? It seems to me that's all this really boils down to. I think in other situations, we might just challenge whether IFRS 3 is right. I mean, I can see situations such as, for example, if you created a new subsidiary in order to and moved part of the business into it in advance of an IPO, I'm not sure that fair value is useful information at all there. I think it's probably more useful information of the historic trends, to allow potential buyers to see that historic trend and determine how much they want to pay for it. So I would just question that there isn't some situations where fair value of the assets acquired is not the most useful. But again, putting that aside, just looking at this, where it seems to be a permanent transaction, something has moved, then this is where it's going to stop. It's not a staging post or an IPO. Then I think the staff are right to say that IFRS 3, we've accepted in the past IFRS 3 leads to the most useful information. Then the question is there any time we should move away from that? And I think, in a way, this is then the next question. Someone obviously said, well, you shouldn't move away from it if there's a non-controlling interest, one little subpopulation, and then you're asking a subsidiary question, or is that always the case? So we're really just narrowing it right down to saying people generally think it's necessary for a non-controlling interest, but is there any subset of that where it's not? And it seems to me at that point it does come down to the value of the information versus the cost of determining it. Now, I think that is actually a very difficult boundary to set by a set of lines of saying, is it public versus private? Is it 5% or 10%? To be able to overrule an assessment of cost v benefit with one simple line, I just don't think it's going to be possible. I think what the staff have said about the public companies, I think that shows that your view is, and I would support it, there's always a case for providing that information for a public company. That doesn't mean that there's not a case for private. You've probably then within the private company, you've got to try and find another line to cut that one up. And it seems to me this really is kind of incredibly complex. And arbitrary, wherever you start drawing those lines. So that led me to think, well, okay, where should we put this decision, this cost-benefit decision? Who should we expect to make that decision? And one option may be something like what's in IFRS 10, where actually it requires shareholder approval, you know? And again, we aren't talking about creditors. All of this conversation might change once we think about other users, but within the context of this paper, if you're just talking about current shareholders, is there some kind of shareholder approval approach? And so, well, actually, you're looking at providing information to these NCI. It's up to them to determine whether they think it's beneficial or not. We have something similar in IFRS 10, or at least we've explored shareholder approval there. Or another case might be, do we just stick with an accounting policy choice, actually? But actually, in terms of that accounting policy choice, the guidance makes it clear that you should consider the specific situation of the transaction, the nature of the non-controlling interest, to determine on a cost-benefit approach whether this information to them is worth the cost, the benefit exceeds the cost. I just think any other attempt to split. Again, we're just talking about one subset. This subset where there's a non-controlling interest effect, to try and find one line that properly solves the cost-benefit equation, I just think is too difficult. However, I can see situations where it really does seem to fail the test. So, I don't know, you've got a parent and a subsid and then a company below that. The non-controlling interest is actually the group. So the group might hold it directly and indirectly through a subsidiary. Then I don't see any use for that information within the context of only current shareholders. But that's an absolute extreme situation. Where are you going to draw a sensible line along the way? I don't know. So I'd try and explore either the preparers or the shareholders making that kind of cost-benefit decision.
Alberto.
I want to congratulate the staff for the analysis they made about the advantages and the disadvantages of identifying in terms of size and quality and so on the possible approaches. And since this is the question you raise, we are of the opinion that among the three possible solutions, we are for a combination of qualitative and quantitative elements. I'm not in agreement when he said could decide an exception for applying current value approach when an SCI is held by employees of the receiving entity. This is because if the receiving entity has a genuine stock grant or stock option plan, I don't see why this they will be affected. So, I mean, I don't see why this exception. Finally, I have a question. It seems implicit to me that in preparing this paper, you have in mind a sort of business combination through exchange of shares. I wonder whether this would work, and in my view should work, also for a transaction through cash, acquiring cash. In my view, this would be even more important because if the transaction is done through exchange of shares in many jurisdictions, at least in Europe, there is some kind of there is company law protecting the minorities. But if you do it with the straight purchase by cash, there is not. So I wouldn't exclude that.
Linda.
So I want to preface my comments to acknowledge that Canada may be an outlier here simply from our environment. So we don't have any requirement for instance, wholly owned subs of a consolidated entity. There's no reporting requirement to make that information publicly available. Unless there's some regulatory filing that has to be done. So we may be an outlier from that perspective. And I say that as a lead-in because the vast majority of what we would call business combinations under common control are driven within the confines of corporate entities, whether public or private, to deal with taxation matters. So, for instance, you have a sub that's making losses, a sub that has is profitable, and in Canada there's no such thing as a consolidated tax return at the corporate level, so you do a transaction so that you can utilize the tax losses. And I would argue in that setting, whether or not there's any management, NCI, whatever, that the user of those financial statements has access to all the information they need, and I don't see any benefit whatsoever in terms of dealing with the current values unless specifically required by the transaction from a tax perspective. And I have done those in the setting in the U.S. where sometimes under U.S. tax law, you're required to make those transfers at fair value. So with that minor exception, I just don't see any reason to contemplate the cost of trying to manufacture fair values for those types of transactions. I think you're considering the right things in the paper, and I think you've discovered in the paper that there's no easy aha, that's the solution, and I agree with you. Okay, I think it's a bit of a complicated thing. I don't think that all the presence of NCI, I don't think all NCI is equal. So you say in paragraph 15A, although information needs of each non-controlling shareholder are the same regardless of the size or nature of NCI, I would have a tendency to disagree with that blanket statement because I think NCI comes in all different flavors. And you can have the presence of NCI, and I'm agreeing with you, Alberto, there, the presence of NCI through some issuance of stock options, in particular if it's a public entity but the stock options are to senior executives, they have access to all kinds of information. So I don't think all NCI is equal, and I think you have to be careful about assuming that the mere presence of NCI drives you to a certain place. So I would tend to agree with you that you have to look beyond just the mere presence of NCI. You also talk about the notion of structuring opportunities around the creation or elimination of NCI, and I have to say, in too many years of a corporate career, I never once tried to structure a transaction to create or eliminate NCI. However, it's really the notion of NCI or a related party kind of relationship means that the transaction price itself may not be representative of fair value. And what you want to protect against is that kind of structuring, because you never want to create artificial gains or losses on these transactions, because you wouldn't want to put out a standard that allowed you to do that. So I think the structuring could come around the transaction price more so than anything else, at least in my experience. So we are actually at an interesting stage because we're relooking at the guidance in Canada. We actually have a standard on related party transactions, and we're working with our stakeholders around combinations between related parties. But the current guidance, I think, gives you some clues as to, you know, whether we tweak it or not, it's helpful. Because our current standard, and even in private enterprise, if it's an acquisition, it very much mirrors IFRS 3. So, and whether or not it's a business combination, a normal business combination, a purchase, or a business combination under common control, in that section, we say, if you're doing this combination in the normal course of your business, or it's not in the normal course, but the change in ownership interest is substantive, and the exchange amount is supported by independent evidence, meaning you can substantiate a non-related party kind of exchange amount, then that's acquisition accounting. And then we go on to say, in other circumstances, this is where you'd use the predecessor method and be allowed to combine at carrying values. And I think ultimately, you have to really consider the needs of the users and ask yourself, and this is where the cost comes in, don't manufacture cost to give users who don't need the information, don't force them into a fair value scenario, which I think others have said, and I see nodding here. So, I mean, I think how you decide to do that, it almost lends itself to say, here's the indicators that you need to examine. It's more like a principle. And then where does the weight of evidence fall to tell you which way you would go? And I know you don't want structuring, but the equal danger is a bright line that doesn't work. So I think you need to consider those things as you move the project forward.
Andrew?
Thank you. Well, much has been said, and I'll try and make some incremental points. So it's a very good analysis, which we appreciate. We've discussed BCUCC in our technical expert group and among the national standard setters in Europe on different occasions from different angles. In discussing various examples that do affect NCI, I think there's a clear majority view that a current value approach does deliver better information. That's not a universally held view, but this is Europe after all, so you might not expect that. Some would observe that the market appears to have chosen predecessor values in applying the IS8 hierarchy when they should be thinking about the relevance and reliability of the information in selecting that approach. But nonetheless, I think the majority clearly agree with the starting premise for this paper that there's more information value in a current value approach. So if you start from that point, we start asking whether we can draw a line in some place. One of the problems, we don't quite know exactly what's on the other side of this line we're trying to draw. I know we're not supposed to peek ahead here, but the predecessor, presumably it's some kind of predecessor value approach, but I think I've said before in this forum that the predecessor method is actually a family of methods. Which predecessor values are we concerned with? Are we going to restate comparatives? So it'll be useful. We'll have to come back to this, I think, when we know what lies on the other side of the line, and that will also help us assess the costs and potentially the relative benefits of the alternatives that are out there. If we're going to draw a line based on the nature or extent of the NCI, then I think Anthony's made all the comments that need to be made. The suggestion about at least looking into whether we could ask the shareholders, similar to IFRS 10, was brought up, although admittedly brought up by Anthony. Fine. So he's consistent on that. There's also some precedent in various, more than one national gap in Europe to ask whether the transaction has substance. I slightly struggle with that, I have to say. I can see that a transaction where you're purely inserting a new holding company, but the ownership interests, there are no new ownership interests or creditors introduced as a result of that transaction, that would not seem to have substance. But that isn't even a business combination, to my understanding. Never mind a business combination under common control. So we're dealing with some other subset of transactions that are business combinations. if an entity is acquiring control of a business, that's going to have substance from the point of view of the receiving entity. I would suggest, although I'd be interested in seeing examples where there is no substance, so we understand what we're talking about when we use that phrase. So of the alternative ways of drawing the line of this paper, I would say as yet no clear winner has emerged in our discussions. If I had to pick the current favourite, it's probably going to be based on listed versus unlisted status, because it seems most objective. I think there's some precedent for that in other parts of the literature. I was personally a little bit surprised by the amount of emphasis on structuring in this paper, which Linda's also commented on. Perhaps I'm naive, but I wouldn't have thought this was an area that was sort of rife with structuring efforts, but maybe I'm wrong.
Jim?
Maybe similar comments. I'll try to be incremental. But I guess you could ask the question of the purpose of the accounting, maybe at least two purposes, and I think you talked about this a little bit, Anthony. Is it to ensure that the non-controlling claimants, I won't call it NCI because there are other claimants that might also be interested, are adequately compensated or not unfairly treated in the deal? And if that's the case, I'm not sure that purchase accounting or business combination accounting ensures that any better than any other method. It's a related party transaction. I think that's where people would get that information. I don't know how you would tell whether you're treated fairly in the deal because of purchase accounting, because the plug is goodwill. And so I don't know how that gives you any more information. If the purpose is for shareholders in the future to be able to do a better job of predicting future cash flows, it wasn't clear to me that the assertion that business combination accounting always provides the most useful information is in fact a true statement. Users often backed out the adjustments made in purchase accounting for purposes of estimating future cash flows. They take out the step up of intangibles. They take out other things and then estimate future cash flows. It's certainly more useful in some cases than others, which gets me to a similar spot, is if you're going to draw a line, is the line more likely to be based upon a public-private NCI difference or not? It's not clear to me that captures the population. I don't know one way or the other whether that's capturing the right population. We had a similar dilemma in the U.S. as it relates to push-down accounting. That's not a common control situation necessarily, but where a parent takes control, do you push their basis down in the separate financials of the subsidiary, particularly if there are other claimants in that entity? And we did go more of a path of, I think, what Anthony described, although it wasn't a shareholder election, we allowed that to be a company election, appreciating that the interests aren't always aligned. They may make an election for unaligned reasons. We weren't sure we could do a better job of determining where the line should be than allowing management that flexibility and then describing why you made that choice. So that's where we ended up, not in this fact pattern, but at least probably in an analogous one.
Patrick?
If I try to not to elaborate on the situation in one jurisdiction, or in particular my jurisdiction, I think that taking into account the fact that you have non-controlling interest in the receiving entity is a key element, because probably, to the best of my knowledge, then you have reporting obligations to fulfill, and in which case you need to be to put your NCI in a position. You shouldn't assume that they have direct access, in my view, because company law will probably restrict those. The controlling interest will have direct access via consolidation, so that's another story. So you have reporting obligations, and therefore you need to put probably the NCI in a position where they would receive similar information if there was no common control. So for me, I think proposed is the right direction. I would have a caveat. I'm not sure that is covered, and maybe it's because I didn't read fully, and maybe a clarification is needed. If the
entity that is combined into the entity with non-controlling interest, if the entity is already consolidated in that receiving entity, for me, then you should stick to the not move to the acquisition method or the current value approach, because you already provide the information to the non-controlling interest on an historical basis via consolidation, and you don't want to disrupt the flow of information. But maybe that is already excluded. I don't know if in your analysis that case is excluded. In other words, if there is a common control, you have separate entities. If you combine one with an entity that are non, that has non-controlling interest, yes, current value is a good approach. Now, if it was the common control was going via the receiving entity, no, you already deliver probably consolidated information, including the combined entity. So maybe that is already covered elsewhere. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure I quite understand the distinction you're making. So what we, the scenario we're talking about in the paper is where you have one subsidiary in the group, so there is a controlling party. That subsidiary acquires another subsidiary.
Another subsidiary or a subsidiary which is in the group, but which is already controlled by the receiving entity.
Yeah, I think, Yulia, if I'm understanding your question correctly, we're talking about an entity that is acquiring a sister entity as opposed to merging a child entity. Is that what the question is?
Well, a child entity, which would have non-controlling interest maybe, with non-controlling interest in the receiving entity. So you have very sophisticated structures where, so if you assume a common control is only via the ultimate controlling entity in the group, no problem. But if the control is going via the receiving entity already, prior to the combination.
Right, but I guess in that case there is no business combination if the receiving entity already controls.
Well, under certain legislation, it's considered a business combination. Huh?
It wouldn't quite meet the definition in IFRS 3, I don't think.
Oh, okay, maybe it's covered, but bear it in mind. Yeah. If it's covered, in other words, if it's considered in the accounting standard as being a non-event, no problem, because it does not affect the consolidated statements of the receiving entity because it's already consolidated. If it's not the case, then stick to the predecessor method in this case. That was my caveat.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Yu Zhen.
Thank you. First of all, I have to say that this project is very important to China. Currently, we do appreciate the efforts that ISB made in this project. And this paper is quite good. It describes the advantages and disadvantages of each alternative. But in our view, that firstly, I would like to share some very rough numbers. I just made a very simple calculation before this meeting that there are a lot of business combination under common control taking place in China. For example, in the year of 2017, there are more than 120 transactions in the listed companies. More than 70 listed companies are involved. The cost, combination cost is more than 70 billion RMB. And regarding the year before, the last year, the 2016, there are more than 300 transactions taking place within the listed companies. Nearly 200 companies were involved, and the cost is more than 150 billion RMB. So that's just the rough number regarding the listed companies. But in China, not only the listed companies has such kind of transaction, but also the non-listed companies. There are a lot of business combination under common control taking place. And from our perspective, in China, we were using the pooling of interest method for the business combination under common control. And it has been implemented since the year of 2007. The stakeholders in China believe that the pooling of interest method is more appropriate for this kind of transaction. There are at least four reasons. The first one is they think the pooling of interest method reflects the economic substance of the transaction. Common control means that the company only changes its internal legal form before and after the acquisition, and the ownership of assets and equities has not been changed. Many of the business combination under common control take place within a corporate group, and the companies involved are related to each other. So the purpose of this transaction is only to reorganize resources in order to better manage the business or for a sustainable operation. So it's just a group restructuring. So therefore, the value revaluation is not necessary. That's the first reason. The second reason is we think the pooling of interest method reflects the characteristics of the development of Chinese companies. China's market economy started very late, and many listed companies are part of the spin-off of the certain group companies. Therefore, many listed companies participating in the business combination are ultimately controlled by the same party before and after the business combination, and the control is not temporary. So if we are using the same accounting method for the business combination under common control, and those are not under common control, it will be confusing. And the third reason is the pooling of interest method reflects the characteristics of asset restructuring at present stage in China. Emerging economies are in the stage of asset restructuring and industrial upgrading. Currently, most of the asset restructuring are not a business combination completed independently between the companies and often present a rather complex ownership relationship. So the acquisition method is not applicable. In addition, most of the business combination under common control are not voluntary transactions entered into by two parties. So the consideration of the transaction are not the result of the bargain between two parties and doesn't represent the fair value. So the acquisition method may undermine the correlation between accounting information and the actual conditions. The last reason is the pooling of interest method complying with the requirement of financing and the regulatory environment in China. The financing and the regulatory environment in China relies on the financial evaluation and monitoring system based on the accounting profit. The financing capacity, financing cost, and the maintenance of listing qualification of listed companies largely depend on the profit in the financial statement. So in this case, the accounting method may have very distinct economic consequence. The use of pooling of interest method can reduce the transaction cost of such kind of business combination and avoid the unfair pricing for intergroup transactions or other issues. So that's our reasons for the use of pooling of interest method. So our suggestion would be that we will suggest the use of pooling of interest method or the predecessor method for all the business combination under common control. Thank you.
I have just one question I want to clarify. So you started your feedback by saying that this is a stakeholder view in China. So I was curious what sort of outreach you have done, and in particular, whether you've spoken to investors and users of financial statements. So essentially, whose views are being represented here?
The project team in my department, they did a lot of outreach in China because, you know, this is not a new topic. It's, as I mentioned, that in China, we require the pooling of interest method for this kind of business combination since 2007. So we keep discussing this kind of transactions in the last few years. And the project, these reasons are coming from the accounting practice and also reflect our views.
Does it reflect the views of users of financial statements? Have you done specific outreach with users?
From users, I'm not very sure whether they did a specific survey to the users. But these reasons are coming from the practice and also from the accounting sector, also from the regulators.
Okay.
Raymond?
Despite the words that Carla mentioned and that are in the paper, I'm still struggling to make a distinction between when will a company be able to apply the current cost method and when will the company be able to apply a different method. So despite all the words that I've heard this afternoon about listed versus unlisted and private companies and the different types of private companies, I think making a distinction between the various entities is going to be the challenge that we'll need to deal with. It certainly seems very counterintuitive to me that you should be able to move an asset from one company to another, from one balance sheet onto another balance sheet, and realize a different value for it. So from that point of view, it doesn't look, I would not be in a position where I can support the approach that has been taken at the moment. I think there's a point that Linda made, which is, are you dealing with an acquisition accounting? Are you dealing with a reorganization? And I think that's quite important in trying to bridge this gap, because if it's an acquisition, then it would make some sense that you would use current values. But if it's simply a reorganization, then I don't think that you should be in a position where you can move one asset from one pocket into another and be able to realize additional value. That's my two cents worth.
Alexandro?
It seems that for every complex question, there is a simple and incorrect answer. No, I think it's this case here, and I'm sorry, but I'm not help. I'll just add another level of complexity here, is that current, in many countries, there are structures where the listed companies, several listed companies, I prepare a very, very simple example here. There's this holding company that's listed, X shareholders, and controls company A, that Y shareholders, another shareholder base, and minority shareholders, I mean, and controls company B, that also have different shareholders. Okay, so three different groups of shareholders that have some intersection between each other. So what happens today if company A acquires company B? People say, well, they apply FRS 3 because they say, well, I don't care if it's under common control or not.
because this is a consolidated financial statement of a listed company that's acquiring another listed company and apply IFRS 3. And if they don't do that, what happens is that imagine that there is goodwill and I do not apply that. I use the predecessor method of use pool, anything. Any cost-based method, it means that imagine a cash acquisition, as Alberto mentioned, that's very important because a cash acquisition makes the, if you have goodwill and cannot recognize goodwill, what happens is that the book value of equity of the resulting company is going to be reduced. And that doesn't make much sense because company A is acquiring company B. It's how do you get, at the end of the day, a lower book value of equity for both companies? So I don't know if I make myself clear. I mean, I'm saying when company A acquires company B, they are under common control, but they are listed companies. They have different shareholders. So you have to acquire, you have to result in some form of goodwill, otherwise you're going to have a reduction in book value of equity. And this shareholder is going to say, well, that doesn't make any sense. I just acquired another company. I'm writing down goodwill. So some of the business combinations on common control, they occur with companies that all of them are listed. And currently, when companies do this, they use IFRS 3. Normally, they don't. They say, I am a consolidated financial statement by myself. So company A is saying, I have my own subsidiaries. And company B has its own subsidiaries. When company A acquires company B, they use IFRS 3. So I say, well, so my point is, it's very hard to find a solution here in the sense that if you do not apply IFRS 3 in this situation, what do you end up with?
So are you saying, just to be very clear, are you saying that you would support applying the acquisition method in all cases if the company is listed?
You can just put substance as what the substance means. I think that people that are against substance mean that they are against tax-motivated transactions because sometimes I have 100% of this company and I have 100%. I'm a holding company that has 100% of both companies. Mm-hmm. And then this company acquires this company. Well, that doesn't make much sense. It's a restructuring only. Right. And for a tax, because goodwill is deductible, like it is in some countries in Europe and in South America. In some countries, goodwill is deductible for tax reasons. So I have 100% here, 100% here, and this acquired this company. It's hard to see substance here. Why it's not an acquisition, it's a reorganization. But when you have listed companies that have different shareholders and company A acquires company B, if you don't have a goodwill, what are they going to have then? So how do you explain, how do we account for this? If you use any cost-based method, you end up having goodwill deducted from book value of equity, which is write down for goodwill immediately. For the shareholder, imagine that you are a minority shareholder of the company which is acquiring the other company. You say, well, what happened? My book value of equity was reduced, but I just acquired another company. So in my view, it's really hard to get away from a fair value method.
Are you saying that you would not use a fair value method where the companies, both companies, are wholly owned by the same controlling party?
Then I'm just opening the possibility that we're going to have a substance discussion. But let's talk about the what I believe is the majority of cases where genuine transactions. And I just put in this example for you because this example is pretty real. It's pretty real. I've been through this situation. My holding company. I know holding companies, listed company, and have a lot of companies on the tree. They're a listed company by itself. They have different shareholders because they have industrial, they have services, they have financials, and they have different shareholders. And all of those companies can be part of a genuine combination. And if you do not apply the IFRS 3 method, you end up having a, what is that? It's a small monster here.
You support.
Yeah, it sounds like you are supporting.
Yes, I'm supporting, but my support, if you don't go that route, what do you end up with?
Okay.
For me, is really, I don't see the alternative really here. It's when you have listed companies.
Okay.
Nobu?
Yes, thank you, Hans. We share many of the views that Anthony mentioned. We think this issue is all about cost-benefit analysis, and it would be very difficult to draw a bright line between these transactions. In that context, we think that the accounting should not be totally different just because there's a piece of NCI in the transaction. And in terms of the order of addressing the issues, we think we need to first confirm whether we have consensus as to what would happen when
it is a combination of two wholly owned entities. And I think there's a difference in views here, and we're not convinced that we have a consensus within this table. So I think in terms of the order, before thinking about NCIs, I think we need to talk about these wholly owned entity issues first.
No, but I really struggle hearing you, if I'm honest.
We need to speak up a little bit, please.
So in terms of the order of discussion, we think you need to discuss the accounting for wholly owned entities first, the combination of wholly owned entities, two wholly owned entities, and then try to extend that to situations where you have non-controlling interest.
Christina?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on one of the views before about using listed or unlisted as a factor. I think if you were to go down that route, it would not be advisable to prohibit unlisted companies from using, say, one method or the other, for example, current value. Because I think there are many AOSSG members who think that there are many reasons why in a private situation or unlisted situation you would still want to do the right thing in providing current value, because they do believe that current value is a better, would provide the best information. So just wanted to just put it, suggest that you don't prohibit any such restriction. If you do go down looking at maybe NCI as the route of NCI, I think there was a suggestion by the group that you could think about looking at some of the existing literature already in the scope requirements. So one was mentioned, which is the IFRS 10, the way the scope requirements work. And another one is the definition of public accountability under IFRS for SMEs. Maybe you could think about whether that sort of wording might suit. And then my last comment is actually it's more of a question. So when we're talking about cost constraint or looking at cost benefit, what exactly are we taking into account under that assessment?
EH?
I think Christina had a question.
Yeah. There.
So obviously assessing cost benefit is a complex task that the board would need to perform. But it's clear that the assessment will be different in different scenarios. So one scenario you can have where you have a listed entity, you have, let's say, 40% NCI. So clearly the benefits of providing current value information to those shareholders are significant. If we compare this scenario with a scenario where, for example, you have almost wholly owned entities, and perhaps you have a few employee stock options issued to key management personnel. So whereas fair value information could be useful for them as well, arguably they might already have access to that information. So the cost-benefit assessment is different. And also, again, the very presence of the controlling party affects the overall sort of blend of information needs and the overall assessment compared to a business combination that is not under common control. So, of course, there is no clear, bright line, and this is something the board would need to think about, but this is what we have in mind when we raise cost-benefit considerations.
Because I think somewhere in the paper, I think you recorded the feedback that there is some stakeholders are saying that maybe measurement uncertainty needs to be taken into account.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if that feeds into the cost-benefit analysis, but... So I think there was a discussion at AOSSG about whether measurement uncertainty is a factor to consider when you're drawing the line. And I think so there is a view that, yes, it is challenging to, you know, provide current value information because in certain jurisdictions it is, you know, difficult to get valuation experts, for example, or have reliable valuation numbers. But there is a strong view from the group that, but if that's the case, then you will have to stick to under IFRS 3. So they didn't think that the measurement uncertainty factor was a strong one. So that's just something for you to think about.
Yeah, and just quickly answer to this one. So obviously, measurement uncertainty is, you know, very high up on our minds, but we think that measurement uncertainty does not play into cost-benefit assessment. It plays into which method you apply in the first place, which is consistent with how we consider measurement uncertainty under the conceptual framework. It affects the whole relevance versus space for representation assessment.
EH.
Yes, I have actually two questions, one for Chen from China and one for Yulia. The question to Chen is that you mentioned that in China, for all BCUCC, pooling of interest method is adopted. And the question is it clear in your local, like a Chinese gap, that you don't have to consider the presence of NCI as a separate factor? So that's my question to Chen. And the question to Yulia is that, have we ever seen any jurisdiction gap, like local gap in any country, where they consider BCCC with NCI and BCCC without NCI in different methods? So any distinction between BCC with and without NC in terms of accounting treatment in different country gap. Is it clear?
Yep. Okay. Thank you for your question. In China, all the business combination under common control are used. We're using the pooling of interest method for this kind of transaction, no matter there is NCI or not. Okay. So for all the business combination under common control. And I would like also to clarify another thing that you are just asking whether we did some survey or outreach with the users, right? Because we just got the paper right before for the SF meeting maybe several weeks ago. So I'm not very sure whether the project team did a specific survey or discussion with the users. I'm not very sure. I will double check with the project team when I'm back. But I would like to say that because the Chinese accounting standards was implemented since 2007, so during the past 10 years, we have several mechanisms and dialogue with different kind of stakeholders, including users, but we never heard that they complain that the pooling of interest method cannot provide useful information. So we never heard such kind of complaint from the users.
I also wanted to react to what Shen Yu mentioned. Recognizing that there is an old and maybe a future debate about pooling of interest in general, but I'm not sure that pooling an interest, the best circumstances would be for business combinations that are common control with non-controlling interest. By that I mean non-controlling interest, real non-controlling interest. I mean outside the sphere of the controlling interest, if I oversimplify, because you can always go back to the state or to a certain extent, but if you have a true private non-controlling interest, then I think there is an interest for, and that has been discussed forever, the discussion has stopped on the merits of pooling of interest under certain circumstances, but probably not, if I may suggest, and we will have further discussions, in the case of business combinations or document control with non-controlling interest. So, and personally, I had sympathy in the past for pooling of interest because I think it might probably solve part of our discussion on goodwill to a certain extent, maybe, without joking.
No.
I'm not saying that we should combine two discussions at the same time because we're going to disappear into thin air.
the other, okay, so I just wanted to see, I would like to explore further your views, your Chinese, your views in China on this topic. Wholly owned, there seems to be a need for clarification, so I'm going to say what I understand, and then we'll see if everybody understands the same. I'm not sure. Wholly owned, for me, under in a BCUCC, its predecessor method. But maybe I'm mistaken. Am I mistaken?
Well, obviously, is that the question?
Wholly owned by the command control.
Is this a question for us?
For example, for my colleagues as well.
So we haven't really done a detailed analysis of that scenario. This is coming. I think it's fair to say that our initial current leaning is that if it is wholly owned, then a form of predecessor method would be arguably appropriate. And of course, we will need to then think about which form of the predecessor method and how it should be applied. So instead of a family of predecessor methods out there, we have just one particular approach.
Okay, which was my understanding and the way I would tend to go. Another remark on what Christiana said, or what several people said. For me, it would be difficult to make a distinction between NCI and to distinguish NCI that are listed and NCI that are not listed. Because unless jurisdictions make a significant distinction between the two. But I think that the reporting obligations, the minimal reporting obligations that are for the non-listed NCIs are already strong enough to require what has been discussed. In the case of listed, I don't see that as a distinction in nature. I see that as a distinction in degree. In other words, there is a super protection for listed non-CI interests. But super protection doesn't mean that there is no protection for NCI in general. But maybe I'm wrong. But that's my perception.
Roberto?
Yeah, a few words about the suggestion put forward by the IFREG representative following the discussion of TFS to apply current accounting if minority shareholders don't. Or otherwise not. Understand that there is a similar provision for subholding exemption in providing consolidated accounts. But I think that it will not work in practice. It will create a lot of problems. First of all, how do we communicate to the minority shareholder? Should we write a letter to everybody? And there may be hundreds, so maybe many, many of them, and maybe unknown. Should we simply put it on the website? Okay. Is it people go to the best website every day to see communication by company in which they are minority shareholders? What other kind of communication? And then how many? Do we need a unanimous 100% on the other side? One is enough, or where do we draw the line? I think it's not workable.
Can I just add one point? But sorry, there's a different point actually. So
I just had a sort of question/observation on Alberta's point.
Okay, mine was a different point.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, you know, hearing the feedback today. So would something like, if we were to say a current value approach, if the entity is traded, if the shares are traded, and if it's not traded, we then look at NCI approval. So essentially combining, drawing a line, and whether it would address Alberta's concern about how we communicate with NCI.
You mean listed or traded? That is different.
Equity instruments are traded. This is what we used in the paper.
Can you add?
Let's say that is different from listed.
Can you add maybe the possibility of an exit solution in the context of the deal?
For instance, if you go a level, sometimes you are obliged to offer an exit solution to the minority interest. If the combination is creating, you know, is minimizing the role of the NCIs to a point where at the end of the day they are not part of the discussion. Normally, there can be for listed companies. There is a case where there is an exit which is bound to be offered. Exit solution.
Which so is a strategy to be a pain. You mean all companies listed or just one company listed?
So we are looking. So what we explore in this paper is whether equity instruments of the receiving entity in the BCUCC.
The receiving entity only.
Yes, are listed.
Why not the acquiring entity?
Well, that's acquiring entities actually. Yeah.
Okay.
You mean the acquired?
Yeah, I mean the acquired. Acquiring, not the acquired.
Yeah.
Peter?
Sorry, I just wanted to comment on the wholly owned point. And the reason the staff aren't able to answer that yet is because to answer that question, you need to have the analysis of the lenders and creditors as well.
Yeah.
Sure.
Exactly. And potential future shareholders.
Indeed.
I agree.
Well, but may I?
Yeah, sure.
No, I think that lenders and creditors in most jurisdictions are protected in the case of business combinations, heavily protected. My personal view in most legal environments, maybe I'm mistaken, I don't know, but I think that in Europe they are protected in case of business combinations.
But are we dealing
the way we're approaching this, as a couple of people have said, we're looking
not
at...
Not
in a cash transaction.
What we're actually looking at is the information needs of the various interest groups. It's not necessarily whether there are protections about the adequacy of the transaction price.
Anthony?
What's the purpose? Yeah, make sure first of all, I was going to say the same, but that's the confusion I talked about earlier on. This can't be about how do we protect people. It's about what's the most useful information and whether it meets the cost constraint. You know, to bring in, as we said earlier on, I've no idea our acquisition account could protect people. But back to your question, I think what your paper showed is that the population outside of current value, yeah, can't be smaller than public. I think that's what you showed. Where the acquiring business is public and it's got an NCI, that's clearly all current account. I think you proved that quite well. That doesn't mean everyone else is private. So back to your question. I think when you get into the private, it's hard to draw the line. And the point that I was making, it was one of two different things to explore. One was about shareholder approval, and we have done it elsewhere. So I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I do take your point, it's complicated. But actually, it's most complicated with public, but they've already fallen out. It isn't a decision then. So you know what I mean? But it does help if what you say is the only time when current value accounting is not appropriate is where, let's say, it's because of employee stock options, or it's because the NCI is actually indirectly held by the ultimate parent anyway, or it's because it's the directors. You know. So then you are told about a small population. They can say, it's okay, we don't want it. They approve them not having... You know, so what I'm saying is, if you look down some of the examples you gave about related parties, it's such a small sliver that you could say, in those instances, they could approve not doing it on a current value basis, and it's completely manageable. It depends on how big you want the piece outside of current value accounting to be. If you want that piece to be bigger, because then you do have to have a more manageable approach, that's where I would bring in the other option, the other alternative I was saying we could for you to explore, is it is about it's about the directors, it's about the management decision on this. It's an accounting policy choice, but you bring in those indicators, and part of it is about the useful information, what shareholders do not have access to cost information, and you provide a proper framework for making that assessment. I'm only saying to explore those kinds of notion is if you want to say in some instances where there's an NCI, we don't need to do current value accounting, you've got, I don't think you can draw a straight line, anyone can draw a straight line to say this is when it's worth the cost, that is when it's not. And that's really what I was trying to encourage you to explore.
Still, you have not resolved the problem of the number of... non-controlling interest. I mean, do you need 100% consent or just one?
No, I think. I th- sorry,
As I say, it's not meant to be the final solution, but the idea that what I was saying is, if you're trying to move away from it, leave it up to the NCI to let you to move away from it is one way of looking at it. Let them draw the line, and then, yes, I think it's all the NCI agree. It's okay. We don't need current value account. Because that's really the question you're asking. Where is the exception from current value account? And that's the way this has been framed. As I said at the outset, you know, there may be other situations where I think predecessor account actually gives more useful information, but we're not talking about that here. There will be the question of other stakeholders, other creditors. We're not talking about that here. But within this confines, if you want to bring that boundary in, I think you've got to manage it carefully. And I don't think it'll do it with a straight line. And saying in this case, it passes the cost-benefit assessment. In that case, it won't.
Andrew?
Thanks, just a few brief points. Just to clarify, when I mentioned this point about shareholder approval, I was just sharing a comment made in an FRAG forum. It's not an FRAG position. And my first reaction was like Alberto's, that seems operationally challenging. Another challenge is, I think, you to do business combination accounting on a fair value basis, you really want to know the accounting policy at the time of the business combination. You can't wait till afterwards, wait till year end and ask the shareholders. But this could be, as you said, worth exploring. On the debate around wholly owned versus wholly owned receiving entities, I don't think we should be confusing the company law objective of protecting non-controlling interests and creditors with the objectives of financial reporting. If this wholly owned entity has to prepare general purpose IFRS financial statements, we should look at the informational usefulness of those financial statements. So, and I would agree with you, Peter, I don't think we can really do that analysis today. I think we need to work through the information needs of different types of user. I think it's going to be rather challenging to identify clear demarcations among those different types of users. So we might end up back with a cost and benefit analysis, which is going to be judgmental. Nothing wrong with that, but need to find some compromise.
Okay.
Hans, I should probably come back to the question about the review of national GAAP that we've done and whether there was a similar distinction. So I think, and I'm looking at Linda to make sure that I don't misrepresent, but I think Canadian GAAP is using something similar because you're looking, one of the factors you're looking at is whether the change in ownership is substantive. So it's a somewhat similar approach.
But by the way, stay tuned because we're looking at that right now. So okay. We'll keep you posted.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I think it was a
surprise.
I learned a lot from this discussion.
Okay, we were half an hour ahead, so now we're still.
Yeah. And so.